In Teaching a Stone to Talk, in one of my favorite paragraphs ever written, Annie Dillard writes this: "On the whole, I do not find Christians outside of the catacombs sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blithely invoke? Or, as I suspect, does no one believe a word of it? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats and velvet hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may wake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us out to where we can never return." It's in that spirit, I think, that we should come before this passage. You can go on and flip it on there. Because it's at this point in the Gospel of John that things really start getting bumpy. The Gospels, in their various ways, tell a story of increasing division between Jesus and the religious folk as they move from skeptical curiosity through entrenched opposition all the way to murderous fury. A division that Jesus doesn't desire, but also doesn't try to prevent. And in fact, sort of actively aggravates at points for a good reason. And in John, the major shift in this happens in chapters 9 through 11. You have the healing of the blind man in chapter 9, you know, as Deborah showed us 2 weeks ago, really ups the ante for the Pharisees. Kind of takes this threat of this whole Jesus guy to a whole new level and makes him much more dangerous to them and much more alarming than he had been. The raising of Lazarus in chapter 11, which Tom will talk about in 2 weeks, brings the chief priests fully on board with the conviction that Jesus must be killed. And in between, in our passage this morning, we see Jesus put a wedge in the crack between himself and the religious leaders of his day and bring the splitting maul down hard. Now, it's important to be clear about something here. There's a difference between being a divisive figure and being a divider. Yeah, and certainly in our day and age, we have far too many dividers for whom turning people against each other is the point. It's a cynical tactic or strategy to accomplish their agenda. This is the story of our politics these days. Think Lee Atwater, James Carville, Karl Rove. The list could go on and on and on and on and on. Jesus did not desire division. He was not dividing people in order to conquer them. But anyone who stands strongly for truth will be a divisive figure, both loved and hated, and sometimes by the same people at the same exact moment. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a divisive figure because, like Jesus, he spoke truth that many people did not want to hear. And just like Jesus, he spoke the truth so clearly and so plainly that ultimately somebody killed him for it. Great unifiers are great compromisers. And while that's a necessary part of things for society to go on, the fact is that sometimes, as we see in the United States Constitution, they end up compromising not only their principles, but their integrity for the sake of unity. I will not presume to be arrogant enough to say that I could have done it better. But we must at least acknowledge the cost. Jesus is the light of the world. And as John makes clear, light divides simply by existing into those who love the light and those who love the darkness. Because never forget, light brings pain. It reveals those things in our lives that we don't want to see, and that we don't want others to see. It reveals things that we value greatly, that we want to believe are valuable, to be fraudulent and worthless. Great jewels to be costume jewelry. It reveals things in which we think we find life to be roads that lead only in the end to death. And it shows us, perhaps most frighteningly of all, that the only way to life leads through the valley of the shadow. And in all these revelations, there is pain and regret and grief and loss, because the world is broken and the world hurts, and we are broken and we hurt. And sometimes in the darkness, we can hide from that for a while. We can pretend not to notice. We can put on our headphones and pretend we don't hear. And then the light comes and we have to face it. And so when the light shines, it reveals a division that is already there between those who believe that light is worth the pain and those who don't. It's a binary set of options. In a windowless room, the light is either on or off. God is not Schrodinger's cat. You don't get both at once. Calling gives us a binary set of options. When you're called, you either respond or you don't. Yeah, the phone rings. You either pick it up or you don't. I mean, you can't do both. There's no third way. The calling of the shepherd divides the sheep in the fold between those who stay and those who follow. You can't have it both ways. We try sometimes. We try to not decide. But how many of you have been told choosing to not to decide is a decision? I can't be the only one. Certainly heard it often enough. Can't be the only one. We can delay. We can put it off. We can wait for tomorrow, for as long as tomorrow keeps coming, but eventually it won't. We can only delay so long. And it's a choice that ultimately has to be made, or else it will be made for us by our inaction. And to fully understand this choice as Jesus is presenting it, we need to really get hold of a couple of things. First is the setting. Because Jesus, what he's envisioning is not exactly what we probably think, you know, from how we're used to using the language. He's envisioning a very typical structure in a village of his land at that time. Sheepfold for the village as a whole is a walled enclosure with one opening, just a gap in the wall. And every family that was well enough to have its own flock would keep their flock there, just mingle them all together. And each would have their own shepherd for their own flock, but they would also chip in together to hire a watchman for the fold who would sleep across the entrance. He would literally be the gate for that sheepfold to keep the sheep in and to keep robbers out. I mean, if you're imagining a door, you can always oil a door. You can oil the hinges. You can get in quietly. Try stepping over a person. Good luck if you can do that quietly. You got longer legs than I do, for starters. And if you climb over the wall, there's somebody right there to hear you. And in the morning, then, he would get up, and the shepherds would come, and each of them would call his flock in turn. And each flock would follow its shepherd, because that's what sheep do. So there's that. We need the sort of the picture of life that Jesus is drawing on. And we also need to be aware of Ezekiel 34, which, after Psalm 23, of course, which we had to call us to worship this morning, is the most important Old Testament text lying behind John 10. And Ezekiel is a prophecy of judgment on Israel, and particularly on its leaders. I thought about reading the whole thing, but it's long because Ezekiel is always long. He was a preacher born, not one for the pithy summary and moving on. But let me give you some of it. Just for, as always with Ezekiel, the violent power of his language. Thus says the Lord God, ah, shepherds of Israel who have been feeding yourselves, should not shepherds feed the sheep? You eat the fat, you clothe yourselves with the wool, you slaughter the fat ones, but you do not feed the sheep. The weak you have not strengthened, the sick you have not healed, the injured you have not bound up, the strayed you have not brought back, the lost you have not sought, and with force and harshness you have ruled them. So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the wild beasts. God goes on from there through Ezekiel to declare that he will be his people's shepherd, to rescue them, to bring them back, to do all the things that the false shepherds are not doing. And then, interestingly, he turns and he says, I will judge between sheep and sheep, between the rams and the male goats, to address the fat sheep of the flock who have exploited the weak, shoving them away from the food, blocking them off from the water, claiming it all for themselves. And he promises his judgment on them as well. And then he says this, I will set up over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. He shall feed them and be their shepherd. And I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David shall be prince among them. And by David, of course, he means the promised son of David who is to come, the promised Messiah, whom we know to be Jesus. And Jesus is drawing on this as he addresses the Pharisees, those standing before him who had just kicked one sheep out of the enclosure for refusing to bleat as commanded. And he calls them thieves and robbers who are more interested in fleecing the sheep than caring for them. And he calls them false shepherds. He declares that those in the fold who are his sheep know his voice, as the healed man in chapter 9 did, literally, and says they will flee from the false shepherds, for they do not know the voice of strangers. The Pharisees don't understand what Jesus is saying. Partly you can understand that, but partly, at least on a subconscious level, they don't want to understand. And Jesus responds very interestingly. He develops his imagery, but he doesn't actually explain what he was just talking about. Instead, he takes it and he does a couple new things with it. You know, in verse 7, he says, I am the gate of the sheep. And he proceeds to develop that metaphor, comparing himself not to the Pharisees, but to all the pretenders that Israel had known, all the would-be messiahs, all the so-called saviors. And he does a very interesting thing with this metaphor of the gate, because sheep in that place, I mean, it's not like we know now where you just sort of have the sheep free on the hills and they can stay out there all day grazing and they have nothing at all to worry about. No, I mean, that place, the places of pasture were dangerous. There were wild animals. They had to go out into danger in order to find the food and water that they needed to sustain life. And they had to leave food and water behind to find safety and security for the sleep needed to sustain life. To do either, they had to pass through the gate. Metaphorically, the gate is the way to life, and thus the path of salvation. And the world keeps generating people who promise us salvation on some other basis than what God offers. Certainly, in this day and age, our politics keeps generating people who claim to be sort of secular messiahs, political messiahs. That, a lot of it was really the story of the 20th century. But in the end, whether religious or political, they all turn out to be thieves who steal and kill and destroy. Some of them start out that way, just that way from day one, such as Adolf Hitler. Some are corrupted by their own self-righteousness. That would be the story of the Soviet Union and Vladimir Lenin. Some are corrupted by the pleasures of power. You might think of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, who started off well and ended up sending his soldiers out to demand that people tear down their own houses and walk with nowhere to go and nothing but whatever they could carry. But all end up there in the end, confiscating property for their own wealth, murdering those who oppose them, destroying what is good about their nations and their cultures. As the New Testament scholar D.A. Carson says, there is only one means of receiving eternal life, only one source of knowledge of God, only one fount of spiritual nourishment, only one basis for spiritual security, Jesus alone. Then in verse 11, Jesus turns a different direction, declaring, I am the good shepherd, linking himself here very closely with Psalm 23 and with the promise of God in Ezekiel 34. And where he's been comparing himself to people who overpromise, to the false messiahs of his age and ours, here he contrasts himself with those who underdeliver, who are just in it for the money and turn and run the minute that the difficulty gets a little bit too great to be worth the salary. Which, I mean, shepherding was hard. It was physical labor, which demanded a great deal of skill. When sheep wandered off, and that's when, not if, there is no if, the shepherd would have to find them and bring them back to the flock, and he'd have to do it quickly because there were predators about. If a sheep was injured, the shepherd had to be able to care for it. And if one of those predators attacked, the shepherd's life was on the line. He had to put it on the line for the sake of the sheep. He had to do whatever it took to protect them from the one that would devour them. The good shepherd isn't doing it for what he can get out of it. He's doing it for the sake of the sheep, because he's invested in them, because they belong to him. And the leaders of this world are all hired hands in the end, when it comes down to it. Even the best of them will eventually break, because their investment in those who follow them, however great and sincere it might be, is not limitless. Even the best reach a point where they can go so far and no farther. They may run, they may hide, they may join forces with the wolves, which sort of connects back to verse 10, or they may get eaten themselves. But one way or another, even the best will fail. There is only one gate who is the way to life, and only one good shepherd who will lead anyone to life, and that's Jesus. And I'll tell you, it's a pastoral temptation to forget that. Being called to say, in a very real sense, thus says the Lord. Being called to seek him, to discern what word he has for his people at any given point, ought to terrify us on a regular basis. Ought to keep us feeling very small before him. But it's really easy, if you get focused on the work, to start to figure that it's sort of coming out of you. To start to feel like it's really you doing it. And the fact of it is, all of us who lead his flock in his name, in whatever capacity, are just sheep with bells around our necks. A lot of churches will talk about pastors as the under-shepherds, and I mean, I get the point, but really we're not. We're just sort of lead sheep. We do our best, most of us, I think, most of the time. but only as long as our eyes and our minds are focused on following him ourselves. We only lead well to the extent that we are being good sheep, to the extent that we are living as sheep. And any time that I think that I can lead out of my own wisdom or my own understanding, my soul is in peril. Because the minute I do that, I am turning away from the living water and I am trying to carve a cistern out of a cracked rock. I am trying to give people drink out of a very shallow pool indeed. And anytime I or you or any of us get focused on following another sheep, whoever it might be, whatever they might have done to this point, to the point that we stop looking to see if they are following Jesus, we're in trouble. And we're contributing to them being in trouble. And if you want to understand that more, just look into the case of George Pell or Bill Hybels or Ted Haggard, for those who might remember that name, or James McDonald. List goes on. It's been a very bad season. Very bad season for leaders in the church. Because we build structures that isolate people from their sheepness and make them think they're something that they aren't. So anytime we get focused on people who are leading and forget to look at who they're following, we're in trouble. And that's especially true if we like the way they're leading us. Now, in my more cynical moments, I sometimes wonder if maybe it's true that Jesus never leads us the way we want to go. In truth, I know better than that. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to say that he never tells us what we want to hear. The gospel is good news, after all. But even at that, it's not good news the way we expect it. It's not good news the way the world kind of lines us up to look for it. And the fact of it is that Francis Bacon was right. We prefer to believe what we prefer to be true. And so we tend, usually subconsciously, but in all reality nevertheless, to see what we want to see and to hear what we want to hear. And so as a spiritual discipline, we need to be actively open to hearing Jesus say what we do not want to hear. And to seeing him lead us where we do not want to go. We need to be actively trying to listen and look against our own inclinations if we want to be confident that we're hearing and seeing him rather than our projection of him, rather than what Sarah once dubbed his fictional essence. And there are a great many reasons why God chose shepherding language to describe himself. But at least one of them is this. It gives us a very humble role of our place as followers, as I've just been talking about a little bit. Because Jesus calls us his friends, but he does not call us his advisors, and we do not follow him as his staff. We follow him as sheep. And sheep are radical followers. I mean, they follow. That's what they do. They don't do anything beyond that. They don't try to navigate. Sheep would never be able to use Google Maps, even if you didn't have hooves. They don't ask to take side trips. They don't complain about what pasture they're led to. I don't like this one. I want to go to the pasture we went to last time. I don't like this water source. The other one's better color. They do not argue about what qualifies as food. Sheep trust the shepherd that where he leads them and how he leads them is what's best for them. Even when that means going through canyons so narrow that you can only ever see the sun at noontime. They trust the shepherd to want what's best for them and to know what that is better than they do. And they act on that trust. They follow where he leads. And that's where sheep, dumb fuzzies that they are still smarter than us. Because we don't. We don't trust that the shepherd really does know what's best for us better than we do. We don't trust that he really wants what's best for us, that he doesn't have some other agenda. Or at least, I don't know, maybe you're much holier than I am. I'm not going to rule that possibility out. But I mean, I don't. And I've never talked with anyone who said any different. I've been working on this myself for a long time now. I've been convicted of this for a long time. And viscerally, I still fight myself to believe it. Because, as John Calvin said, the human heart is a factory of idols. My heart is constantly finding things that it wants to love better than God. And so I struggle to believe that he really knows what's good more than I do. Because subconsciously, I do not want to believe that. I mean, I know God says that this behavior or that thing is not good for me, that it's not really life-giving. Cognitively, I understand why. But down here, I do not want that to be true. And so my sinful nature rejects it. I want to believe that whatever feels like life to me in the moment is therefore life-giving. And I don't want to give up whatever gives me pleasure without effort, whatever gives me satisfaction without struggle, whatever gives me a sense of significance without risk. And I don't want to admit that I'm wrong. And I think subconsciously this is going on in all of us, and sometimes it really rises to the surface. Sometimes we get ourselves dug in and committed to the proposition that we do know what's best for ourselves or for others, and that if God disagrees, he's just wrong. You know, a Presbyterian colleague of mine said once, friend of mine on the very liberal end of the scale, that if Jesus himself came down and told him that homosexual sex was a sin, he would reject Christianity. Now, regardless of your take on sexual morality, I think we can all agree that that's idolatry. And I mean, it wasn't personal for him. I mean, he was married to a woman, seemed to be happily married. I'm not going to say that he was in any way false about that. Yeah, it was a faith commitment for him. On the other side of the teeter-totter, I had people at a previous congregation who were deeply offended when I took the Pledge of Allegiance out of the worship service and got really mad when I tried to explain that our allegiance to God must come before our allegiance to the United States. Again, that's idolatry and nothing short. Our hearts are continually being led astray by our desire to believe to be true what we want to be true. We're constantly affected by the temptation to conform our faith to our comfort zones. I loved the way Dana put it this morning, that people are comfort-seeking missiles, and the warhead is predictability. Which is why we make our churches to fit that. It's why, as Annie Dillard puts it, people in churches seem like cheerful, brainless tourists on a packaged tour of the absolute. And it's why her invocation of the peril of our faith is so urgent and important. Because if you really get serious about following this Jesus character, you're just liable to end up crucified. I mean, if we follow him, that's where he went. And ultimately, whether it's the religious folk or the powers that be who do it to you, is ultimately immaterial. You know, I mean, the nails feel the same regardless of who's driving them. But as I've said before, Jesus is unreasonable. And what he asks of us who follow him is unreasonable. By our standards, anyway. And I think that's the dividing line, really, in our day and age. Maybe in others, but you know, in Western culture, at least since 1799, when Friedrich Schleiermacher published his book On Religion, Speeches to Its Cultured Despisers, Western culture has increasingly insisted that Christianity must be reasonable on society's terms. And on that basis, Jesus is offensive to our culture in at least two ways. One, he claims to be the gate and the good shepherd. Definite article. He says only his sheep will ever find true life because he's the only way to God. He insists that God sets the terms of our reconciliation with him, rather than letting us set whatever terms we feel appropriate. He says it's not about us and what we think is appropriate, because it's not about us making a way to God, because in fact, we cannot make a way to God. It is simply beyond all of our collective capacity, all of us together. And instead, he says, God made a way to you. He opened the way for you, and I'm it. And second, the deepest commitment of our elite and popular cultures alike is the belief that individuals are defined by our desires. We are what we desire. And thus we have the basic right to do whatever we desire as long as everyone's good with it and no one gets hurt unless they want to. God couldn't possibly want me to give that up. It's who I am. That's what we say. And I do mean we, because this covers the waterfront. Do not think I am aiming this in a particular political direction. I mean, certainly, we talk about this, we tend to focus on sex because that's what sparks the nastiest discussions, the nastiest arguments. But this is also about whatever each of us has written on our palm leaves this morning. This is as much about me and my desire to pastor a church again as it is about anyone or anything else. And I'll tell you, the last 4 years, I have had my nose rubbed in this. That desire does not define me, and God owes me nothing. And sometimes that burns in ways I could not express to you. You know, we say, God couldn't possibly want me to do this. It's too much to ask. And then we look at Jesus and we realize he gave up everything. Being in his essential nature, God, he did not regard equality with God as something to cling to. He didn't regard equality with who he actually was to be something he needed to hang on to, but made himself nothing. So Paul says, he traded infinite pleasure and the full experience of the presence of the Father for sorrow, suffering, grief, and pain, and reliance on a long-distance connection. And more than that, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death by torture on a cross. This is the road he walked for us. This is the one who asks us to follow him. He wants us to follow him. This is where he goes. And he wants us to follow him as a sheep and just trust that that's the way to pasture. Crash helmets and signal flares, indeed, that doesn't begin to cover it. The fact of it is, following the Good Shepherd does not guarantee us anything we want out of this life. It puts all worldly pleasures at risk. It doesn't even guarantee us the spiritual satisfaction we think it should. Read Mother Teresa's never-supposed-to-be-published memoir of a sort, Come Be My Light. She spent most of her life in ministry. It's a life of dedication to God beyond what most of us could imagine doing, with no sense that God was with her. And she struggled greatly with that. That's an extreme case. I've never heard of anyone else who has tested that sorely. But it illustrates the point. Following Jesus is not a bargain that we make, that we will follow him if, and whatever that fill in the blank might be. He calls us to follow him not if, but regardless, like sheep. He promises us two things. He promises us himself. And though she could not feel his presence, Mother Teresa still knew he was with her because she saw him in the faces of the beggars of Calcutta. He promises us himself in the most unlikely places. And he promises us his life. To the world, this does not seem like hope because it does not promise that things will get better. But in truth, it's a better hope because it's the hope that even when things don't get better and we can't see how they'll get better, all is not lost. And indeed, all is deeply well, even so. That fundamentally all is well with our souls. That's eternal life. That's the life of the kingdom of God. It's the life of Christ in us. And it's not just something that we have after death. It's something he gives us now. It's not what the world thinks is life, but what the world calls life is ultimately empty. It's a life that offers joy in the midst of sorrow and peace in the center of the storm. But we can't know that from the outside. We can only step into it by faith and put him to the test and find that he is faithful. We don't have to do it perfectly. Again, we follow a sheep. He knows what that means. Sheep wander off. They wander off without even trying to. It's what they do. They don't really see past the patch of grass that's right in front of their nose and the back legs of the sheep right in front of them. He knows that. He knows we're prone to wander. He knows that going off to bring us back over and over and over again is part of the deal. It's the life of a shepherd. He's the good shepherd. He's the one who never tires of going after us to bring us back from whatever hole we've managed to fall into, whatever blind alley we've managed to get ourselves stuck in, whatever peril we've managed to discover. It's just part of his work with us. We don't have to be better than sheep. We just have to be a sheep. And let him do what he will and lead us where he will. Radical followers who have learned the truth, C.S. Lewis put it, that Christ plus nothing equals everything. And Christ plus anything equals nothing.